It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. Representatives may be away for their August recess, but things are continuing to heat up for fall elections.
First, we're taking a close look at what agencies in Wisconsin have received military equipment. Records from the state's Department of Military Affairs show that over 67,000 pieces of military equipment have been given to local law enforcement departments in the last 10 years.
The departments got this equipment as part of a federal program that gives military gear to police departments nationwide if the Department of Defense doesn't use it. The program is called 1033.
Here to talk about the program and how Wisconsin agencies have benefited from it is Nick Penzenstadler. He's a reporter for the Gannett Wisconsin Media Investigative Team. Nick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Well, what is this 1033 program?
So this is military equipment that either has reached the end of its military use or is surplus and was never used. And instead of scrapping it and getting rid of it, the military chooses to offer it up through this 1033 program to local law enforcement agencies across the country.
Do these agencies have to pay for it, or is it a donation sort of thing?
They only pay for transportation and then maintenance. So like in the instance of a vehicle, they would pay to transport it to wherever they are, and then they would pay to maintain it, you know, oil changes, that type of thing, but they don't technically own it.
So when we talk about military-grade equipment, what exactly are we talking about?
Well, it's a really wide range. It's everything from night vision goggles all the way up to rifles and helicopters and grenade launchers and even assault rifles.
Now, this is stuff that obviously makes sense if you're talking about the United States military. Why do police departments need it?
Well, the thought is that they're trying to keep pace with a criminal element that has higher powered weapons. Down in Fond du Lac County in December, there was a man who had a 50 caliber sniper rifle that would have, you know, shredded a normal squad car, so they said they needed their armored truck to protect officers responding to that call.
So it's considered to be something police departments need on a case-by-case basis, but not maybe an overarching change in the scope of crime?
Right. I mean, it's free to the department, so they see it as, you know, we can't afford this otherwise, so we should get it now.
Now, you've been tracking this gear over a 10-year period. Where has it gone?
A really wide range, from the really small agencies, like we set up here in Fond du Lac and Outagamie County, and all the way up to, like, the DNR uses some of it. There's a training facility near Volk Field that does a lot of training with this equipment that gets a lot of it, but it's everywhere. It's 219 agencies across the whole state.
So the DNR uses it. Why does the DNR need it?
Well, they mostly get vehicles for, like, a rescue scenario, so they've received over 30 motorcycles that were military-issued, and they use those on forest roads and other hard-to-reach areas. So maybe not so much the weaponry, but more of the equipment.
Is there a particular force department in the state of Wisconsin that has received more of this than others?
Yeah, well, our investigation found that Juneau County was actually top on the list. They're nearly $3 million since the program began, which is mostly vehicles and small equipment, but also they do have a large MRAP vehicle, which seems a little odd given that there's only about 25,000 people that live in Juneau County.
Right. Have you got a sense over this 10-year span whether the police departments who've received this sort of military equipment have actually used it?
A lot of the vehicles and the smaller things, I mean, it goes down to, you know, jackets and boots and you know, pliers, that type of stuff definitely gets used, but I think it's a little debatable whether the combat-ready type equipment gets used, because that's really prepared for either an emergency or a riot or crowd control like we saw in Ferguson, which has obviously brought this to the forefront.
Right, and right now we're looking at closer scrutiny about how militarized police forces should be. Do you see that this sort of reapportionment of military gear is going to come under, you know, a closer look here in Wisconsin, and maybe it's not all going to pass muster?
I think it will. I mean, we've heard President Obama call for a sharp separation between our armed forces and our police departments, and the ACLU is taking a look at this, and I think it's really coming down to oversight, and it's not should these departments have it, but how should they use them and when.
Are you seeing concern among citizens, maybe other agencies, that because police departments have all this military gear now that they'll be more inclined to use it?
We've definitely seen that. I mean, we had a new military-type MRAP delivered here in Appleton, and people reacted pretty swiftly that they didn't really want to see it unless it was absolutely needed, and they kind of scrutinized whether it was needed in the first place.
Now, MRAP, what is that again?
That's a mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicle. So they're built really for those roadside bombs that we saw in Afghanistan.
Right. So police are thinking that maybe if you got one of these in your back pocket, it could one day come in handy. Can they give it back, though, if it doesn't, and if the forces that be decide police don't need this kind of militarization?
Yes, and we've seen that a little bit around the country where some city councils, and there's been some citizen drive to give these back, and communities that say, we don't want to be a part of this, and we want to give it back. We've seen a mix of that in Wisconsin. Some agencies choose to go to the councils and get approval. Others just say, we're getting it, and we're going to use it.
Well, I imagine you have to store it, you have to maintain it, and you have to train personnel on it. Is some of this military equipment a drain financially?
We haven't really found that. We've heard a lot of people say the costs are very minimal, especially when you consider on like the MRAP side, you know, it's a $700,000 piece of equipment that an agency likely wouldn't be able to afford otherwise, and the routine maintenance is a small price to pay, is what they tell us.
Is part of the legacy here from this military equipment the war on terror, when the United States was in a higher state of alert and police departments were thinking, you never know, this could be something we need?
Sure. Well, it actually goes back even further to the war on drugs in the 90s. And I even heard some local sheriffs referring to the North Hollywood bank robbery where the police were really ill-equipped to handle assault-type weapons. And this was trying to make sure the police were ready to meet that force. But yes, then after 2001, rather, it really accelerated, and we had this focus on making sure we were ready for terror attacks wherever they may come.
Are citizens aware, do you think, that police departments have all of this equipment?
Certainly the more visual things, like the trucks, are easy to see, and it's a big symbol of this. But the really small items are surprising, especially when you look through our database, which we'll be publishing online at Postgres.com and other Gannett sites. It's really mind-blowing how many individual pieces of equipment get transferred.
Now, you looked at Wisconsin for this investigation. Is it a fair assumption that other states have similar programs?
Yes. Almost every state in the country is taking part in this. It's ballooned to almost $5 billion now of surplus equipment that's been distributed all over. So these agencies individually apply usually to a state agency, and then it goes up to the Pentagon, and it filters down. But just this year, there's been a massive wave of these MRAPs coming back from Afghanistan, or that never got shipped, that local police are using.
Given what's happening in Ferguson, Missouri, are you seeing police departments here in Wisconsin who are themselves reflecting on this equipment and being proactive about giving it a look over and seeing whether or not they want it?
Sure. I think we're definitely seeing that consideration. I think police are still weighing the cost-benefit, and they're saying, you know, on that balance, we'd rather protect our, you know, residents and police officers than be in a situation where we really need an armored truck or a piece of equipment that we don't have. So I think you're seeing people think about it, but maybe not change their minds yet.
Well, Nick, thank you so much for coming on and telling us about it.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
That was Nick Penzenstaller, reporter for the Gannett, Wisconsin Media Investigative Team. It's time for our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. The House and Senate are still in recess for the rest of August, but the news from the midterm campaign trail continues to flow, and legislators from Wisconsin and around the country are weighing in on topics ranging from the unrest in Ferguson to threats from the Islamic militant group ISIS.
Paul Singer joins us every week at this time to give us the scoop on what our representatives are up to in Washington. Paul, great to have you back with us.
Great to be on. How are you all doing?
Good. Well, the protests in Ferguson are continuing to dominate headlines. President Obama made remarks about the situation on Monday, and Attorney General Eric Holder is in Missouri today. How have members of Congress been responding to the shooting and the subsequent protests there?
You know, the interesting thing has been how particularly presidential candidates or potential presidential candidates have been really flying kind of under the radar here. I mean, I think for lawmakers, the only real practical stance at this point is to call for calm and to urge everybody to de-escalate, if that's a word. But they don't want to get in the middle of this conversation about whether the police officer acted inappropriately, whether Michael Brown, the victim here, was engaged in some sort of criminal activity, whatever. It is all best for politicians to simply, you know, pray for America and say, let's all wait and see what the facts show us. because I think there's a real danger for any politician of getting out in front of this thing and saying something stupid or something that turns out particularly later not to be true.
Or, yeah, look stupid after the fact. And but what about those, I can understand maybe the president or maybe a Wisconsin lawmaker not wanting to comment on a situation in Missouri, but what about Missouri lawmakers and the senators there, the representatives there? Do they have more of an obligation and a responsibility to get on the forefront and to try to at least assemble some kind of constructive community dialogue about it?
Well, yeah, but again, part of that is, you know, a lot of the lawmakers, you know, obviously, if you don't directly represent that area, you're going to stay away. And at that point, now the question is, well, what should the governor do about it? What should the state do about it? I think folks have largely supported the governor's decision to send the National Guard there to try and you know, reestablish calm. It looks like maybe that's been a little more successful. Last night was not as bad. You know, I think we are still in a kind of breaking crisis mode. There is not a lot that people can do, but I think there will be a lot of opportunity to talk about, you know, what are the underlying tensions here that are creating this problem in this community. You know, there are a lot of folks asking questions about whether we should still be sending this much military hardware to local police departments. Is that inappropriate? Is it too much? I think we've already seen people promising to introduce legislation or hold hearings to reconsider arming local police departments to the teeth. That kind of stuff on a policy level you can talk about. But I don't think there's a whole lot you can do at this moment in Ferguson.
And do you predict that some of those conversations and those issues will become part of the campaign trail come 2016?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. There will be conversations about, in fact, there's already a petition at the White House with 100,000 signatures on it to, you know, require police to start wearing cameras so that you're always tracking the police activity. You'll see other folks trying to push legislation to, again, you know, reconsider whether we need to be sending this much military hardware to the police. I suspect you'll have a whole series of conversations about, you know, what are the appropriate steps and the required steps for the National Guard and for state responses, this kind of stuff. There'll be a lot of it.
Well, we mentioned last week, that you would be following up on the GOP Senate primary in Alaska that was decided
Indeed.
Yesterday. So it sounds like former Alaska Attorney General Dan Sullivan won that primary. Is that what you expected?
Yeah, pretty much. The question was only going to be whether Sarah Palin's endorsement late last week of Joe Miller was going to tip the balance at all. Joe Miller is kind of a Tea Party active kind of fellow, and with Sarah Palin's support in 2010, sorry, I get my years messed up here, he actually beat the sitting Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski in the GOP primary, which was a huge upset. And Lisa Murkowski then, despite the fact that her name is hard to spell, ran a write-in campaign and won the Senate seat back, which is fairly dramatic. So Joe Miller has been sort of wandering around in the wilderness since then, and Palin endorsed him for this race. And the question was whether that would be enough to push him over the top. In the end, it wasn't. Sullivan had all of the establishment Republican money behind him, and he is considered, I think, the tougher candidate for the Democrats to handle in the fall. The Democrats really wanted to run against Joe Miller because they think he's easier to paint as an extremist.
Mm. Well, and the word is that this is one of the races that will decide which party takes the Senate this fall. Now that we know who the Republican contender is, are there any further predictions on who's going to take that seat and how it might affect the Senate as a whole?
Well, it's a very close race. We expect a very close race between Senator Begich, the incumbent, and Dan Sullivan. We expect that it'll spend historic levels for a Senate race in Alaska. I believe the current estimates have been that $8 million already been spent in this race. And so it is going to be a barn burner. And, yeah, this is one of a half dozen races that will determine whether Republicans or Democrats control the Senate next year. There will be an enormous amount of national attention, which is funny because it's a tiny little state, really. You know, there's not a whole lot of people up there. So they have an opportunity to have an outsized impact on the national politics.
Is it drawing a lot of out-of-state money into Alaska?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, lots and lots. Every every major organization, left and right, will be spending a lot of money on. Of course, the challenge with Alaska is there's only so much advertising dollars you can spend. There's only a couple of TV stations. There's not like, you know, what can you do other than, you know, fly people up there and put them on the ground and start knocking on doors and mm-hmm. drag them to the polls.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that's something that you'll be keeping your eye on throughout the season, and we'll keep checking in on that. On the topic of fall elections, a new USA Today Suffolk University poll found that in North Carolina, 62% of voters in North Carolina see their votes for legislators as votes for or against Obama. What does that tell us about how elections are going to go this fall?
It's a really interesting finding, and I think it speaks particularly for Republicans that, you know, if you can make this race about Obama, if you can make a Senate race about Obama, you are going to paint the Democratic senator or Senate candidate with some of the unhappiness that folks feel about the Obama administration. Obama's popularity is very low to start with, and things have not been going particularly well for the administration recently, and there's still some lingering anger about Obamacare, the health care law. So to the degree you make this a national referendum on Obama, it really works to, we believe, to drive people away from the polls, drive Democratic voters away from the polls. What was interesting also about this thing is that even the Republicans even the Democrats see it as a referendum on Obama. They believe they have to vote for Kay Hagan, in this case, in North Carolina, to support Obama, which is, again, very, very interesting. I think the Democrats in general will benefit from making this a local race, making it about what's best for our state and what's best for the issues on the ground. But it is very clear that for some proportion of the population, they believe, particularly the Democratic base voter and the Republican base voter, they believe this is all about voting for the guy who will either support or oppose Obama.
And isn't that the strategy that was taken in 2010?
And in 2010, of course, the advantage was for Republicans in general was this sort of, there's this huge Tea Party wave that everybody was unhappy. They were happy about the government, they're taxed too much, the economy was in the tank. So they were able to really nationalize the emotion of dissatisfaction. Of course, the problem is that they unleashed a movement that they can't even really organize themselves. They're having all kinds of trouble with those same people now in Congress, getting them to vote for stuff that they need to pass.
Mm-hmm. Well, here in Wisconsin, Senator Ron Johnson is back, and he's in the state for a recess, and he announced that starting today, he will be holding town meetings to warn Wisconsinites about the threat to the U.S. of the Islamic militant group ISIS,
who
we've been hearing about in the news. Some say he's fear-mongering. Others say it's his duty as a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. How does this response compare to other members of Congress?
You know, that's the first I've seen. I saw that today. I was like, he seems, honestly, it's a little out ahead of where everybody else is. I mean, I think it is not clear that there is a direct threat to the United States from ISIS at this point. However, it is clear that this is the group that we are most concerned about sort of taking over from al-Qaeda and becoming the real international terrorist group. I would be very interested to see and hear sort of what he offers at these town halls and what kind of suggestions he's making. My suspicion is he's more concerned about Americans traveling abroad than he is about attacks on the homeland here in the U.S. And again, this is a little further out there than I think a lot of the rest of the country is, that our leaders are willing to go to really suggest that we focus on the concern, the direct threat to Americans. But it's clearly this is the new face of international terror that Americans need to be worried about.
And on the other hand, in our last 30 seconds here, is his role on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee giving him some information that maybe no one else has?
It's possible. I'd be more interested to hear what the Intelligence Committee says, but they won't tell us. But sure, I mean, I think the senator obviously has a concern, and I'd be really interested to hear his concern. And the question is, you know, exactly how far that concern needs to go, and does he really think it's time for Americans to panic or just take caution?
Mm-hmm. Well, Paul, thank you again for being with us today.
Hey, my pleasure, and have a great day.
You too. We've been speaking with USA Today Politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us every week at this time with the latest from Congress. month, we're taking a look at the culinary history of the Midwest with a chef who decided to explore her family's culinary history. She wanted to find out how she became the food lover she is today, and she decided to delve into the lives of her ancestors.
She's here to share what she discovered and to share some of her favorite family recipes. Kathleen Flynn is the author of several books. Her latest is called Burnt Toast Makes You Sing Good, a memoir of food and love from an American Midwest family. Kathleen, welcome back to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So how big of a role did food play when you looked at your family's history?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I actually started this whole book because I wanted to recreate my dad's chicken and dumplings recipe. And, you know, it was something his anniversary of his passing about 30 years ago, it had come up in 2010. And so I asked my mom, hey, do you have that recipe anywhere at all? And she got a box down from her closet. And in the box were recipes, but there were also all these stories that she had written about their years on our farm, this 10-acre farm in central Michigan, and stories about them leaving everything in the late 1950s when they drove across Route 66 to go out to San Francisco to work in my Irish uncle's Italian restaurant, and stories about my father growing up in abject poverty during the Great Depression. And when I went through these stories, and I had never seen them before, my mom had been scrolling away for all this time, I was really struck by how much in every single story there was this theme of food. And it all, even stories going back to my great-great-grandmother, Anna Erickson Monk, who arrived in America in 1890 with a single suitcase, and she couldn't speak English very well, but she found out that cooks made more money than housemaids, so she told everybody, I'm a cook, yeah. And she settled in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan in the Newberry area. And from then on, I found out when I did the research that in every generation, people in my family worked as cooks, or cooking was their passion. And I was struck by that because it was something I hadn't realized until I really started to kind of root around in my past.
And it sounds as though sometimes food stood in for communication in your family. It was a way that you expressed love. And speaking of love, I love the quote that you have from your grandmother in the front of your book. She says, "I don't have to tell you that I love you. I fed you pancakes."
Exactly. And I think that is, you know, so apt, really, because if you think about, I'm sure my family was not unusual. And in fact, I think when I compiled this whole story, it's the story of my family, but I think that many people, particularly in the Midwest, will really see sort of this immigrant story of people coming from different, you know, coming from different parts of the world, marrying into, you know, other kind of ethnic backgrounds, and then sort of the melange that happens with all their food. But I think one thing that was very common, you know, when I was a kid, and definitely in the generations before me, is that, you know, some big life event happened, say there was a death or a birth or something else. I mean, the very first thing people did was say, well, let's take them over some food, you know, so that they don't have to worry about feeding themselves. And it was a way to really connect and to nourish with people. And I still do that today. I know that there's still a lot of people who follow that tradition. And I think that food often is a way to really communicate and say something when you sometimes don't know what else to say.
You know, today, a lot of people, not a lot of people, but some people are fearful about food, about cooking, that you really have to know what you're doing to even attempt to cook something in the kitchen. Your parents, on the other hand, just took off to California to help run a pizza parlor. They didn't know anything about pizza. How did they end up there?
My uncle Clyde, who is older than my dad, it's a little confusing exactly how he ended up with this Italian restaurant. His partner was this murky character who I think may have had some sort of dodgy connections. He was actually Italian and then was sort of out of the picture pretty early on. But he owned this Italian restaurant, and he could have hired somebody locally, but he was very close to his family, and he took care of his younger brothers and sisters. And So he called up my dad because he knew that there was a big recession going on in the late 1950s. And my parents dropped everything, and they drove across Route 66, ended up in the Mission District, and they had only had pizza in an actual restaurant one time. And it was a Shakey's Pizza in Lansing, which is still there. And other than that, they had tried the newfangled Chef Boyardee package, you know, where you get the little can and you get the dough and everything. And they tried that once or twice, and that was it. That was, but they were really fearless. And I think that it was very much a sign of the generation that they came from. They were part of what's known as the Silent Generation. They were the children of the Great Depression. And so my father grew up thinking that it was really normal that everybody went to bed really hungry at night. And I think when you come from a place where you're just happy to have enough to eat, you know, it really can, I think it really offered them a great sense of sort of optimism. Like everything else is up from here, you know? And I think it made them very resilient individuals. And as a result, I think as their children, they taught us the same thing.
Well, your parents eventually settled at a farm in Michigan. How did living on that farm, close to the land, close to food production, how did that influence you and your makings as a chef?
You know, it's funny. When I was a little girl and, you know, I really wanted Wonder Bread and, like, bologna sandwiches and sugar cereal because it was all the stuff I couldn't get, you know? I mean, we always want what we can't have. And then when we moved from the farm, all I wanted, and today all I want are the flavors of the farm. I want really wonderful tomatoes that, you know, you can pick, you can smell them before you even pick them up, or to sit in a strawberry patch and just eat strawberries right from the vine and have the homemade bread and that kind of hearty, very simple food that my parents, you know, grew up on and ultimately taught us. I mean, the whole thing started because one day I was lonely for my father and I really wanted his chicken and biscuits. And still to this day, when I, you know, if I feel like I need a pick-me-up, I'll do something like make my Uncle Charles or my Uncle Clarence's cornflake crusted chicken, because there's something that always haunts you, I think, about the flavor of your childhood.
Did you ever find your dad's recipe for those chicken and dumplings?
No, we never did. So I decided to work on, and in the book I have my mother's chicken and biscuits recipe, actually. And it's pretty, I think we've replicated her recipe pretty well. But the dumplings have always eluded me. My dad's his dumpling recipe, something about his dumplings.
But yeah, sometimes
I'm still working on that.
Sometimes they don't write them down. Sometimes they're so much a part of you that you can never, you know, find them in writing anywhere. That's one of the things about being a family cook.
Yeah, it's really, that's so true. My grandfather was actually, my maternal grandfather was a cook in the Army during World War One. It actually turned out he became a cook because he had been busted for bootlegging as a teenager and had spent time in a county jail, and so he wasn't eligible to fight. So they transferred him to Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio, Texas, where he learned to make chili and all kinds of stuff and was a lifelong cook. I mean, just loved to cook. But in my family, he was the one who made all the jams and the jellies because he kind of considered it sort of an art, you know. And my mom and I had tried over the years to try to replicate her favorite, which was blueberry jam, and never was quite there. So then we were in Asheville, North Carolina, and we sat down at this place called the Tupelo Honey Cafe, and they brought us some blueberry jam, and my mother took a bite. She put it on a biscuit, took a bite, and she started to cry.
Huh.
She was just overwhelmed, and I said, "Mom, what is it?" And she said, "This tastes just like my dad's."
Oh,
and
wow.
That it was a recipe, and they had a cookbook for sale, and that recipe was in it, and we got it, and we made it, and we figured out what we were doing wrong is we were always adding too much sugar. And so, but that small bite, you know, she just was so flooded with all these memories and, like, just this love, you know, for her father and the times that she would spend in the kitchen with him making jam.
Yeah, food can be that direct line right to the memory, can't it?
Definitely.
I know that your book, it's special because it's not just a memoir. It shares some of these recipes. And one of these very special recipes in your family is cinnamon rolls, especially birthday cinnamon rolls. Mm-hmm. What's so special about those to your family?
Well, when we were living on the farm, my parents had bought into, they became partners in a business with his brothers. It was actually aluminum siding, very, you know, hot thing in the 60s. And it just happened that the business folded, and they owed a great deal of money to friends and family who had lent it to them, and also a couple banks who had lent them the money to help start that business. And so my father could have declared bankruptcy, but he didn't want to leave the people who had trusted him often just on his word. So my parents decided they would pay everybody back. They went on a plan. They were going to do it within 7 years. And as a result, we really had no money. We were on the farm. Fortunately, we never had a problem eating because we had this big farm and mom and can, and we raised chickens, and my dad always got a deer. But that meant that we didn't really get much in the way of, say, birthday presents, for example. And so instead of some expensive gift, my mother would let us each order whatever we wanted for our birthday, so at lunch or dinner. And we'd spend a lot of time thinking about it. Like, mine was always like fried chicken and mashed potatoes and stuff like that. And but one thing we always wanted was cinnamon rolls. And the ones that my grandmother made required two risings, so they took kind of a long time. My mom didn't do them regularly. But, you know, because she felt like, wow, you know, her kids kind of were missing out on, you know, new bikes or, you know, going on family vacations and stuff other than, you know, going fishing, she would get up at 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the morning so that she could make these cinnamon rolls for us on our birthdays before we went to school.
That's love, double rye cinnamon rolls. Well, we're talking right now to chef and author Kathleen Flynn about her new memoir. It's called Burnt Toast Makes You Sing Good.
We want to hear about your family recipes. What dishes are famous in your family, and what's the one thing you always have at holiday meals or birthdays? You can call in and share your recipes and memories at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org.
We're picking up our conversation with Kathleen Flynn about her new memoir about her family's culinary history.
And we're taking your calls. What one recipe says it all about your family? How has your family's history been shaped by food and the way that food tastes? Call in with your recipes and your memories at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send an email at talk@wpr.org.
And we're going to go now to Kathleen, joining us in Menominee. Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi, thank you.
What is your food memory?
Well, when I was very little, my grandmother that lived on northern Michigan, up on the UP, had raspberry patches. And she made jam, and we also just ate from them. But that only goes up until I was 7 years old, maybe. And we moved further away and didn't come home as often. And he passed away when I was 7 or 8. And then when we came home, Grandpa had taken away the berry patch years and years and years later. And I'm a grown woman with a baby, and I'm visiting a friend who I had just met. And, oh, she says, here are some raspberries on my counter. We just picked them this morning. I don't know, how nice. And I took one bite, and the tears, like Kathleen mentioned when her mother ate the blueberry jam, and the memory of my grandmother came flooding back. It was just lovely. It was just lovely.
That's a beautiful memory, fresh raspberries. And it's interesting that two similar experiences there, that there's just sort of this hotline between the mind and the emotion and food, which I guess explains why, Kathleen, your family was so deeply wound up between food and memory and love. Do you think that's unusual, or do you think this is something that's true with a lot of families?
I think it's true with a lot of families. I mean, I think that one of the things that, you know, when I was newly married to my husband, and one of the things I wanted to do is to make the dishes that he remembered from his childhood. Unfortunately, his mom made a lot of things out of boxes. And so one thing that he loved was something called Noodles Romanoff, which had, you know, was discontinued in 1994. And I actually searched and tried to remake that for him because I wanted, you know, to give him something, this flavor and this experience that, you know, he missed because his, you know, his late mother used to make it for him. And the other thing he loves and he'll still do is he'll use his mom's mixer. It's from 1962. It still works, the Hamilton Beach. And he'll make a cake and make the same kind of cake that he made with his mom's. And when he does that and that process of making it and, you know, and dipping and licking the bowl and making it into a cake, and I don't even really like cake, big cake eater, but I love it when he does that, and I want to share that with him because I think that that kind of experience is just a pure expression of love.
Now that we live in the age of computers and, you know, you can just search for something on Epicurious or just on the internet and we don't often write down what we pull up or tweak, are we losing something when we don't leave a paper trail that has our, you know, our chocolatey fingerprints on it?
You know, that's really interesting. I think actually we're missing out on the fact that a lot of people don't cook. I mean, I think sometimes some of these recipes are getting lost with a generation that, you know, kind of does take out or thinks cooking is too messy or, you know, they don't feel confident in the kitchen. I did my second book was all about that. I did a whole project trying to understand what holds people back from cooking. And, you know, one thing that people will make, even if they don't like to cook, is they'll often make, like, the holiday recipes. It's actually, those are the ones that are probably the most likely to persevere. But if you have a generation and maybe a second one and they don't cook, those recipes, I fear, really do get lost. One positive thing about the internet and all of these recipe sites is that a lot of them allow you to collect them together. Where, you know, even my grandmother, she had a recipe box, and, man, they were all over the place. And so, you know, and I think it allows people to formalize and have, like, the right quantities and that sort of stuff that you don't have when you're just writing it down.
I want to thank Kathleen for that call. And we're going to go next to Tom in Greenfield. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I was going to just make a comment about the topic you were just speaking of as far as lost recipes. I come from the same kind of Midwestern background where food was important and cooking and farm families, and those would be families of my great-grandparents, actually. And my great-grandmother's recipes were all written down and in a file box similar to what was just described, unorganized though it may be. But her recipes were like one blue bowl of flour, one red cup of sugar, one green spoon of vanilla. And those recipes were not lost to my family because my mother actually had the foresight to go into my great-grandmother's kitchen before they broke up housekeeping and moved into a retirement home and measure the bread bowl and the blue cup and the green spoon and find out exactly how much each of those measures were. And we still now have some of those same recipes that have been transposed into more standard units of measure, I guess you would say. I'm so grateful. My mom's since passed, but I'm so grateful to her for that because I can still make my great-grandmother's blueberry muffins if I want.
Oh, that's a fantastic story. And do you also, Tom, still have the Red Bulls and the blue cups and all that?
No, we do not. No. But we do know what their values were.
Oh, well, that's...
That was the most important thing as far as not losing that connection to the food. And my wife and I both come from similar families of people who still do cook. And thankfully, our children do, too. So I don't think we're totally lost on generations that don't cook because I think that's an important skill and something that's really important to pass on to our children as well.
Great. Thanks for that story, Tom. Kathleen, what do you think?
Oh, I love it. My grandmother, that's so funny. I laughed when he said that because my grandmother's recipes had very similar notation. And my grandfather, who rarely wrote anything down, he actually said a fistful of this or whatever. And she had a lot of pinching and, you know, whatever and stuff like that. And my grandfather was 6'4". I mean, he was a big guy. I mean,
his fistful
is quite different than my fistful. So I don't know that I'll ever know what that is. But she also would say, go pick the largest chicken out of the pen. That was one of her other recipes, which is, you know, I don't even know where to go with that. But I love it. That's really great. And I think it really does show that you know, she was measuring with what she cooked with every day. And I think that is not as uncommon as you might think, because when you look back at older recipes, particularly going back in like the 1800s, there's a lot of that, because there wasn't as much, there might have been in, you know, kind of more professional kitchens, but homemakers, you know, there wasn't necessarily a standard cup or, you know, a standard tablespoon. Even today, tablespoons are different in the United States than they are in the United Kingdom. So there are, you know, flexible variations everywhere, which fortunately in cooking a lot of times doesn't make as much of a difference, but in baking, everything can go wrong.
Well, let's make time for this one last call. Sarah from Madison, you've got about 30 seconds. Sorry to rush you, but what is your food memory?
My food memory from my grandmother is, well, she cooked all the time, but the one thing that stands out is she would make coconut cream pie, and she would make the custard homemade. And anytime I smell that, it just brings me to tears. But it also thrills me to my core. So I'm so excited about this program, and I think it's important for people to cook and to keep those recipes alive, because it's, I don't know, it's just, it's really important, and it's healthier.
Right. Well, thank you so much. Coconut cream pie for Sarah brings her to tears, makes her emotional. And if you're looking back, Kathleen, is there one iconic recipe that you have to have, you know, in your life?
Yeah, I actually would say, my grandmother's lemon meringue pie. That's funny, she just said that about a pie, too. When my grandfather was very ill toward the end of his life, he didn't have much of an appetite for anything. The only thing that he wanted was lemon meringue pie. And so every day for 4 months, my grandmother made him a fresh lemon meringue pie every single morning.
Oh, that's beautiful. And we have to leave it there, Kathleen. It's been really fun to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That was Kathleen Flynn, author of Burnt Toast Makes You Sing Good, a memoir of food and love from an American Midwest family. She's also the author of The Sharper Your Knife, The Less You Cry.